case this afternoon is Smith versus Smith. Good afternoon.
Your Honor, Durbaum, my name is Pat Hang. I'm with the North Platte Law Firm of Waitnick Law, and we represent the appellant Shane Smith in this case. This case comes up to the court from an appeal from Red Willow County on a divorce action. Underlying trial involved issues of custody, child support, alimony, and property division. The trial court judge entered a award for the appellee with regard to the custody and child support, awarded no alimony in the initial decree, and then made a property division. Prior to that, property division included the appellant's retirement fund that was set up through the state statutes regarding firefighters with for cities of the first class.
Would you agree that the Lorenzen case that was decided after your briefs were submitted has decided the issue on that being a marital asset?
Well, I would probably agree with that at this point, Your Honor. So,
moving on.
But after the trial occurred, the motions for new trial were issued on both cases, or by both parties. The appellants dealt with the issue of the retirement account. The appellee's issue dealt with the issue of the alimony and child support. The trial court then granted the motion for new trial on the appellee's. For the appellee, awarding an alimony award of $800 a month for 84 months. In the judge's subsequent order, the motion to trial, he concluded that it looked back at the same evidence, essentially. In the initial decree, Judge Doyle indicated that he looked at all the factors pertinent to an alimony award and concluded it was not warranted. On the second order, he basically looked at the same factors but put more detail into the analysis and then came to the conclusion that alimony was entitled. It came to him before the statute of 25-1142, which is the motion for new trial. The motion for new trial is a statutory creature which can only be granted in rare cases when you have one of those eight factors that are applicable. And Judge Doyle didn't indicate any of those are applicable. In fact, none of them could be applicable because we're dealing with the same set of facts both times. We're just doing a 180 on the decision.
Can't the motion for new trial be treated as a motion to alter or amend?
Well, it's the statutory scheme. I mean, the case law, I think, is the Turbines case essentially indicates if you're, and Judge Irwin, or excuse me, Judge Doyle's decision says he's looking at it under the motion for new trial, that he's reviewing the evidence and boom, 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 and then he comes up with his decision. Statutes that pertain to when you're going to grant a motion to a trial indicate you need to find one of those factors of why you're doing that. Otherwise, the sanctity of the judgment you have, which is part of the reasoning rationale behind it, is you got a judgment and the person, the party that has won that judgment fairly, absent prejudicial error, should be able entitled to keep that judgment. If nobody had filed an appeal 30 days later, this would have been a final order.
But this was filed within the 10 days it would be appropriate to request an alteration of the judgment as well, wasn't it?
That is correct. It was filed with intended, which was also the reason then for the motion to trial was granted by the judge.
And since our Supreme Court has said that a post-judgment motion must be reviewed based on the relief sought and not based on the title of the motion, and in particular in this case, I don't believe the motion for new trial actually even cited a statute, did it?
No, it was just very, very general.
In both cases, yours and your opposing counsel.
And I think ours, yeah, we didn't cite statute, we cited the rationale, just like I think they did.
So if we're looking at the substance of what was being requested, it could have been to alter or amend the judgment, which gives the trial court the authority to change its mind, doesn't it?
Well, if that is what the trial court was indicating, but in reviewing the trial court's, I guess, in the order on the modification of the original judgment, the judge is basically following what he's concluding is a motion to trial. I guess it based on his language is what we're guided by as to why he's doing what he's doing.
Mr. Hank, in reading your brief, it seems to me your complaint here is about the procedure. The judge shouldn't have flip-flopped on a motion for a new trial. My question is, if alimony had been awarded in the original decree, while your client may have been unhappy, would it still have been the basis for an appeal?
That probably would have been up to the client. My guess is, based on the factors and based on this court's review of cases on alimony issues and this set of facts, it would have probably been something I would have advised and might not have been a decision to make from a standpoint of the likelihood of success, because I think the court has granted a great deal of deference to district court judges from a standpoint of alimony or the property division allocations, and therefore, no. I mean, it's going the same way,
yeah.
I guess.
And I just want to make sure that we're addressing what your complaint is. I mean, is your complaint that on the procedural basis, the court shouldn't have done this?
The court should have done it. I think factually, the court could have been correct, I guess, looking at some of the other cases from this court and Supreme Court indicating reviewing those type of alimony decision as to whether awarded or not awarded based on the fact that the court has given discretion both ways to the district court judges in those kind of decisions.
So you are conceding that you are not asking this court to review for an abuse of discretion the alimony award?
Well, I think that would have to be the standard if we're asking this court to make a change on that, because I think...
But did you, in your request for relief on appeal, ask us to consider the alimony award for an abuse of discretion, or as Judge Reedman has indicated, are you only asking us to consider the procedural error?
Well, on our assignment of errors, the procedural standpoint based on Judge Doyle's findings was based on the fact he utilized the motion for new trial as a rationale for when he made his 180 on the decision of alimony, and so the abuse of discretion would be then the granting of, or the changing of his mind was an abuse of discretion based on his original decision granting no alimony.
So you're suggesting that we should consider whether there was an abuse of discretion that he changed his mind and did award alimony, period?
Well, if the court is, he has a right to, assuming he has a right to make those decisions, yes, we would say it would be abuse of discretion the fact that he awarded alimony in these circumstances.
Because he changed his mind and didn't do it the first time?
Given the fact that he reviewed the exact same evidence twice and came up with two separate decisions with nothing else before him other than those, the same set of facts.
Was a request, I want to switch gears a little bit, with regard to the retirement fund that I think we now understand that Lorenzen may control,
right,
in that case. Was a request made for the marital equalization judgment to be allocated through a quadro, a qualified domestic relations order? Was that request even made?
And we didn't try the case, Your Honor. I don't recall seeing that in the record. I think and that's a second part of what happens here is the court being a marital asset, I think you look at the result. I think if you look at Judge Doyle's attachment D to his initial decree, the very last thing about a property settlement isn't fair and reasonable. And if you look at these folks' history, quite honestly, he has like $700 other than this retirement account, and she has the house and some equity. And then also you put a $50,000 judgment on an individual that has working three jobs at the time already, now has child support and alimony, and now a $50,000 judgment. I think the court, in its discretion, abused its discretion in going the route it did when it had other alternatives that could make it a lot easier on this individual. I think that's part of what a property settlement or a property division should be, is that it's fair and equitable, but also fair and reasonable, so that you don't have a hammer hanging over either party's head in a form of a judgment of that amount. When we can see from the assets, there's no way to liquidate that unless you're going to cash out this retirement account with the penalties and taxes you're going to incur. So that was part of it. That's also part of the disagreement why the quadro should have been a route to go, just because right now you put an individual in a situation where he's a judgment debtor to his ex-wife and really no means, if you look at his assets and look at his background, with no means to satisfy that.
Thank you.
Back in. Your Honor, may it please the court, I'm Kevin Erbaum. I'm appearing on behalf of Deborah Smith, appellee, pardon me. The court has kind of taken some of the wind out of my sails here today. I wasn't familiar with the Lorenzen decision, thank you very much. So I'm going to make this really, really brief. My brother came in yesterday and asked me if I was ready for this, and I told him I thought I'd repeat Judge Doe was right 50,902 times. I thought possibly I ought to address a couple of the issues that have been raised. The first would have been what's been taken care of by the Lorenzen decision. It would have required that the district court assume some evidence which was never in evidence. There was a joint property statement filed which listed this 401k. There was testimony by Mr. Smith that the 401k existed. Nothing was ever said about it being a substitute for Social Security. Even without the Lorenzen case, I think it's properly decided.
So the import then of including that in the marital estate, which I think we all now agreed was appropriate, and the monetary judgment, can you address the appellant's argument that imposing that monetary judgment is inequitable in terms of the way it was done, a lump sum?
Rather than a quadro, or
anything like that.
Well, Your Honor, the cases have seemed to help hold historically that a quadro is a means of enforcement of a judgment, not a means of entering a judgment. I guess I don't see too much difference between ordering a quadro and ordering a $50,000 judgment. They seem to me to be pretty much the same thing.
Well, one has to be paid in 30 days to avoid interest, and the other will be paid upon someone retiring or other conditions of the retirement plan being met. So there is a difference that way, isn't there?
Certainly, there's a lot of differences. A $50,000 judgment, just standing alone, is going to probably require enforcement efforts by Mrs. Smith. A quadro, by its nature, draft the quadro, send it off to the company, they pay it, divide the accounts, whatever they do. So it actually is more of a burden on Mrs. Smith to have a $50,000 judgment rather than having an order on quadro. There are the tax ramifications, tax possibilities.
There was no evidence about that.
There was no request that a quadro be entered.
Because at that time, the law was not yet very clear, was it, with regard to whether or not that retirement, those funds were marital or not marital, whether they were substitutes for Social Security. The law was not clear at the time.
No, it was not clear. And the evidence was also not clear that it actually was a substitute for Social Security. The evidence was simply that it was a 401k and that it had $137,000 in change in it. There wasn't anything else. And frankly, I don't remember whether at the time I knew that this was somehow a substitute for Social Security, but certainly there was no evidence adduced at any time, no testimony. The appellant complains about the motion for new trial, and I realize that the record doesn't show the order in which those motions for new trial were filed. However, the motion for a new trial that was filed by the appellee, by Mrs. Smith, was actually filed in response to the motion for a new trial filed by Mr. Smith. We requested the entry of an order for alimony and a recalculation of the child support in our motion for a new trial. They requested that the $50,000 be recharacterized as non-marital property in their motion for new trial. If they had not filed a motion for new trial, I doubt that Mrs. Smith would have done so. I think she was probably satisfied with the way that it turned out anyway. So it just would not have happened.
It was a good deal. She got $800 a month in alimony as a result.
Which is why I thought about coming in and saying Judge Doyle was right.
Would you agree that's a bit unusual for a trial judge to change his mind on the decree of no alimony to using the same evidence and going down the same factors than awarding alimony?
Actually, I don't know why
the change of mind occurred.
Actually, I was pretty happy to start doing the research and find out that what district judges have been doing to me for 30 years is right. I always thought of a motion for a new trial as a stalling tactic. You know, something to get myself another 45 days, maybe, before I had to file a notice of appeal. And if I was lucky, a district judge might correct some things that I thought were probably inequitable, so that I wouldn't have to do an appeal. I probably should have stylized them as motions to alter or amend. I've never filed a motion to alter or amend. I've filed motions for a new trial. And they always ended up being treated this way. So maybe I'm in error doing that. But it seems like the case law is settled that a motion for a new trial that's filed within 10 days of the entry of the order can be treated as a motion to alter or amend. And I believe that the judge did so. Whether it's unusual that a judge would grant alimony when they didn't grant any in the first place, sorry, I can't speak to that. I don't know.
That might have been a rhetorical question.
Okay. I have nothing further. You have questions?
Do you know whether, because I don't recall seeing the judge address it in the amended decree, as to whether the judge looked at what the income looked like after Mr. Smith paid child support of $1,200 and $800 in alimony, which you add to Ms. Smith's income. In essence, didn't it take Mr. Smith well below Ms. Smith's income level?
Mr. Smith had income of approximately a little over $5,000 per month, as I recall. Mrs. Smith had income of approximately $1,200 per month. The child support, which was ordered, I think, was about $1,200 a month.
Yeah, Mr. Smith's net was about $4,100. Ms. Smith's net was about $1,300.
Right.
Right.
A good portion of what he would have been paying was child support.
$1,200.
Correct.
That comes out after the net. And the $800 in alimony would come out after the net.
Correct.
Reach, right?
Yes.
Is it your position the law supports taking the paying spouse's income to less than the receiving spouse's income?
I don't know that there's any law or any rule of thumb or anything concerning that.
There is some case law that talks about how alimony should not be used to equalize incomes, right?
True. I'm aware of that.
Okay. So if we're not to equalize incomes, it seems logical that you wouldn't reduce it below.
But the question from my mind would be whether it's the alimony or whether it's the child support that's doing that.
Certainly, the alimony is the issue here, right?
That's what they're complaining of. But the child support is the larger award on a monthly basis.
And the child support's pretty mathematical, right? Where alimony...
To my knowledge, it's completely mathematical.
Alimony's kind of like...
Why is the question in your mind whether it's the alimony or the child support that's doing it?
No, it depends on which one you apply first.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Well, I think the rules require that the court look at child support first before determining alimony.
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
Okay.
So, I don't know of any guidance that we have as far as whether you can reduce a paying spouse's income below receiving spouse's income. Certainly, if you're paying $1,200 a month for child support, it's presumed that those payments are made for the benefit of the children rather than for the benefit of the spouse. This is a situation where Mr. Smith removed his earning capacity of about $5,000 per month from the household. They had an outstanding mortgage, very little equity in the house. So Mrs. Smith actually didn't receive much as far as property is concerned. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Hank have remaining?
Some time, I hope.
33 seconds.
And I'm going to just try to ask the same question one more time in a different way on the alimony, which we've just been talking about. Are you, through your brief and your argument, asking this court to look at whether the court was wrong in applying the evidence and the law to award the alimony it did, or just in relation to the changing of its mind through the motion for new trial?
Well, my brief addresses the lack of factual history with regard to the alimony award. I mean, there was, quite honestly, this was basically a custody case, and that's where it looks like the parties focused. But with regard to an alimony award, I think the brief addresses that issue from the fact that there wasn't a lot about her history or his history, for that matter, as to, you know, who took care of the children, all of that. That wasn't really the party's focus. So the record did not have a lot in it, you know, to allow Judge to do his 180 on the issue of the alimony in the first place. I mean, that's, and the other thing, just the pay stubs had no Social Security coming out of it, so that we didn't know, I guess, in lieu of Social Security. So.
All right. Thank you, counsel. You are excused, and the case is submitted.